Welcome to Roger and Me, a podcast that aims to celebrate the late, great Roger Ebert, keeping his unique spirit of film criticism alive each week by reviewing all the new movies coming out every Friday in an easily digestible format on a podcast, not on television. We don't have the reach that good old Roger had. My name is Brett Arnold. I am at Brett Redacted on Elon Musk's Twitter. I'm here with Mark Dusick at Mark Reviews on the Elon Musk website. We are here to talk about 8 new releases for Christmas weekend. Happy Christmas. You can tell I'm Jewish. I'm like, happy Christmas, everybody. Merry Christmas.
Or British. What are the two?
is that what they say? I feel like they're all over the Merry part. I feel like they say Merry in other contexts or something.
Yes.
Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, all that stuff. We are here to talk about the movies out on Friday, December 23rd. And also, there's some weird release dates going on because it's the end of the year where studios have to like toss movies out on the into theaters and call them 2022 releases if they want to be eligible for awards or whatever it is. So most of these things are out as of today, Friday, December 23rd. Some of them came out on Wednesday, the 21st. Because it's a holiday week. Some of them come out. I feel like if it wasn't a Sunday, movies would have actually come out on Christmas Day. That usually happens. Maybe there are some. I don't think there are, but Broker comes out on Monday.
Some of them were scheduled to come out on Christmas Day, and then I think they pushed them back to Friday because they realized that was
weird.
Because
it's like, except,
Broker
Sunday.
Is coming out. Yeah. Broker's coming out on Boxing Day, which we don't even celebrate in the US. So I'm like, why? What? What is that release strategy? I don't know. Maybe they just wanted to make sure that it was going to get like a full week of release before the end of the year for awards. I have no clue.
Sure.
It's a weird one.
And then we're not talking about the Tom Hanks movie. It's called A Man Called Otto this week, but that's another weird one where I think it's coming out January 13th wide, but they're sneaking it out in New York in like a couple theaters starting December 30th, which is like such a funny last minute. This is 100% so they can get, I think they have like the Oscar play for that movie is an original song by Mrs. Tom Hanks. She does an original song for the movie. Rita Wilson, is that her name? So I think that's the reason that movie is getting a 2022 last minute one theater release. So it's that time of the year. We've got 8 today that are a mix of, what is it? They're mostly theatrical, almost all of them, except for one we tacked on the end that I think, is it already? No, it's not out. White Noise is out.
No, it is out. Yeah, that one has been out. Yeah, but it comes out on Netflix next week, which adds to the confusion. But because we're doing end of the year wrap up next year, or next week, we're going to do White Noise ahead of time of the Netflix release.
And I caught it at a festival at the New York Film Festival. Right. So I've seen it a while ago. I'm going to have to lean on you there a little bit, but I did like it and I do remember it fondly. So I will be spirited in the discussion of all the films, even though I saw, how many of these did I see at festivals? I saw White Noise and Women Talking at the New York Film Festival. I could have seen Corsage and Broker and Living at Living was at Sundance and I missed it. Broker was somewhere and I missed it. Corsage was at New York Film Festival and I missed it. It's actually nice to catch up with some things at the end of the year because there is stuff like Living, which premiered, you know, in Sundance in January and had definitely some acclaim for the performance. But I did not hear anybody say anything about this movie. Like no one put this movie on my radar and said, you got to see Living. And I just caught it and we'll talk about it in a few minutes, but delightful movie. And if I had seen it in January, I just wonder if I would have remembered it. And I'm glad that I saw it now. It feels like it might factor into end of year stuff. It's a very good movie. So we're going to start with, oh my goodness, I sent you the order. I'm going to go in the order we spoke about earlier. So I'm going to start with Babylon, but I do have a couple notes actually for myself. So I'm going to actually get to them, which I never do. We actually have hit the threshold on Spotify to have our star rating shown. That means we have 10 reviews on Spotify. So thank you to the 10 listeners I know are out there who definitely like us. We've got 10 5-star reviews. We're 5-star podcast right now. We haven't been dinged by anybody. So let's keep that going. If you're listening to the show on Spotify, please give us a rating. It really helps us surface and helps other people find us. So we appreciate your reviews. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, also really important to give us reviews. We haven't had any since like the first week. So if you're listening, that'd be great. I know there are a few hundred of you out there. So if you could, if we could activate you in any way, please do the action. If you're on YouTube, if you're one of the 40 people watching on YouTube, I appreciate your diligence. There's not a lot of you, but you're coming back every week. And
we make sure we at least have semi different shirts on each week YouTube, you know.
We've done wardrobe changes.
We had to for Avatar.
Yes. I actually completely forgot to do it, but
Yeah,
I was gonna say, I'm trying to remember. I don't think I actually did it. I know we said we were going to, and then I came back and just didn't. But one of us did, and that counts. we put in the effort here. Speaking of putting in the effort, Damien Chazelle really went all out for his fourth film. Is that it? Whiplash. We've got Whiplash.
We've got La La Land.
First Man, which is like his misbegotten son that nobody
also
likes,
did one,
but it's actually good.
He did one like very low budget indie movie before Whiplash.
Oh, before Whiplash. Okay.
So this might be his fifth.
Got it. I don't know if I've seen that one. I forget what it's called. I'll have to look it up.
Got it.
But we're talking about Babylon, a very expensive movie, a very long movie, a movie that I have no idea how. It's one of those things where I'm like, bravo, Paramount. You did not give this man any notes. You let him make his movie that he wanted to make, because you would know if this movie had notes. It basically announces itself as the studio had no control over this right away. So here is the trailer for Babylon.
If you could go anywhere in the whole world, where would you go?
I always want to be part of something bigger.
Yes.
Let's go! Something that lasts, that means something.
You know, when I first moved to LA,
I got your face touching you, Linda.
You know what the signs on all the doors read? No actors or dogs allowed. I changed that.
Good morning.
Good job for you.
I'll do anything.
That's the cocksucker they said to screw us.
Yeah! That bitch is stealing the scene right from Mommy. She's icing her nipples so they perk up through her dress.
I ain't icing my nipples. This is natural. What do you say we come in for my close-up now?
It makes me want to watch this movie again. I feel like it's going to be a very spirited, fun conversation, because this is... It feels like it's got to be one of the most divisive, one of the most polarizing movies of the year. It's one of those movies where I wasn't sure about it almost the entire time I was watching it. And then the third act clicked for me in a way that made the whole thing sing. And I think it takes a huge swing, especially at the end, that is going to really split the room. People are going to either be mystified and like jaw on the floor, like, wow, this really hit for me. Or it's going to be like a unbelievable type of reaction, and I'm assuming you're more in the latter department on that one, but I'm excited to talk about it. Mark, what is Babylon?
Babylon, as the title probably suggests, is a huge epic about the silent era of Hollywood moving into the talkie era with a giant cast. There are cameos here that I didn't even realize happened until well after the fact. And even watching it a second time, I didn't catch all of them to begin with. But the main characters, you have Diego Calva playing Manny Torres, who's like this gopher for this fictional studio in Hollywood. Margot Robbie plays Nellie, who's this up-and-coming starlet, or at least she wants to be. And then Brad Pitt is the leading man of the time, who is going to realize that maybe the talking pictures aren't quite for his career. And that's basically it. It's just following these three characters. Oh, there's a fourth character who kind of gets forgotten, including by myself and by the movie itself. He's a trumpet player.
Just like a black character in another divisive movie on this podcast. I would argue his absence is completely deliberate and the point, and we'll get into it.
Oh my God. Oh no. We're not going to bring that up. Armageddon
time.
I will name him.
For Armageddon time. Yes.
Armageddon time again.
Yes.
Anyway, so it's about these four characters, three really, going through day-to-day life and the years passing in Hollywood. I'm divided within myself about this movie because there are sequences and scenes and ideas in this thing that I loved. There's this just
the Kraken
day
score.
In the life.
I love the score.
The score is fine. I liked the song that the score is made up of. That's what I'll say. It's a good tune. But after a while, like in that third act, I started to be like, I've heard this song so many times, and that's what you're going to keep using. Okay. Anyway, beyond that, that's irrelevant to the point. But there are sequences here. I love the day in the life scene where it's just, you know, Robbie's character learning that she can act really well and everybody realizing, oh, this is an actual star we have on our hands here that came out of nowhere. Calva's character running around trying to get a camera at the last second so that they can capture the light for this perfect romantic shot, and Pitt's character doing all this wheeling and dealing on the phone, coming up with like lines for movies that haven't been made yet but are slightly different. I love his alternative ending to Gone with the Wind. I love that line. That's a funny bit.
Yes.
And then there's another just piece of comedic inspiration where they're on the set of this, you know, the first time the studio is actually making a talkie, and they're trying to get the microphone adjusted and the blocking right, and everyone is just going insane on the set trying to get everything perfect.
It's a great scene.
It's so funny. It is so funny. And everything in between those moments, there are some good ideas and some interesting character beats. I really like Pitt's character. I really like the sense of defeatism that he brings to that performance. You don't quite expect that from him, even though, you know, I know he's a great actor and everything, but there is something very sad and soulful about this character that I haven't quite seen from Pitt in a while, if ever. I really like his performance. Robbie is fantastic as usual here, because she's just playing this ball of energy.
This pure, who, like, narcissist actor type in Hollywood who just wants to make it and literally crashes into the scene and just makes it in Hollywood, which is like the whole crux of the movie, right? It's just about how Hollywood used to work and how it still works or doesn't, and how people, like, so many people's stories, if you were to ask them back then, like, how'd you make it in the pictures? It was just like, they found me on the side of the road and said, can you find me an elephant? And then like, you know, 2 years later, I'm running a studio. Like, there are so many stories like that. So this movie, like, kind of comically, I would say, that's like the plot jumping off point for like all these characters. It's just like, you get like the Manny who just is, as you said, a gopher and like makes it in like the back way, like through like doing jobs no one would want and like mucking through the shit, so to speak, as the movie would put it.
Yeah, within the first like 2 minutes.
Very off-putting. It, and like, I will say, it's so much so fast that like, I would have argued this harder before, but I've really grown to love it even more since I've seen it. But like, I really found it like the humor to be off-putting and like grating up top. And like, I'm just like, this isn't like what's funny about a elephant shitting into the camera, right? Like, what is this? And then when the movie reveals itself to be what it is, and like, you kind of get what it's going for, like, I'd be really excited to watch it a second time now and like see if all the things that I found annoying the first go and just like flourishes. Like, literally elephant shits on the camera and then a grown man is being pissed on by a woman in like the next scene. So like, it's just like, and then there's vomit. So like, all the orifices are covered. It's a lot, and I didn't know what it was going for. And even though that opening scene is like maximalist and like well done,
it goes on way too long for the very little information we get out of it.
Yeah, it's just like this celebration-y, like the bombastic sequence that, you know, hyper indulgent and is like what the trailers I feel like are selling this movie as, but it's not the whole thing at all. It's just like, that's one part of it. But I kind of loved what the movie ended up being, which is like, you know, as a film fan, I know you are as well. And I'm sure as a film fan, you're also a huge Singing in the Rain person. And it is just, there's an inherent like delight for me in just what is basically watching a guy make Singing in the Rain, but from like 2022 and his inspirations are like Paul Thomas Anderson and Martin Scorsese movies. Like, it feels like Singing in the Rain if it were done in the style of Boogie Nights or Wolf of Wall Street. And like, that inherently, I know, I'm sure that entices you on paper more than the movie did for you. But I find that if you're willing to get on the movie's wavelength and just follow its, it's a very acidic movie. And like, a very, what I found striking about it is I just was going in expecting, based on nothing but my preconceived notions, based on what I thought it was going to be based on. I don't think I watched the trailer. I'm just saying, I don't think it was based on anything other than Damien Chazelle, the guy who made La La Land, is making a movie about like Hollywood's transition from sound, or from silent to sound. It sounds like it's going to be a love letter to that era. And while it does ultimately become one, and I think it is, the message I think ultimately is, it is all worth it in spite of it all. Like, I do think that is the ultimate message. But it is like, it's two movies fighting each other, right? It's like the magic of the movies versus the reality of the business of making movies. And it seems like you're watching a guy who just maybe had his movie that was supposed to be a Best Picture winner that didn't quite get there. Like, was at the finish line and thought maybe he got it, but didn't get it. And then he did a follow-up to that movie that bombed completely, critically and at the box office, even though I think critics have come around to it. And there definitely were some at the time who said it was great. And I'm one of those who came around. I did not like it, but I totally admit that it's a good movie.
Are we talking about First Man?
Yes.
Absolutely. I love First Man.
Yeah,
I love First
really,
Man.
I got the 4K. Good on you. I wish I had that reaction. Unfortunately, I saw it in IMAX, had the incredible experience of seeing that final sequence in that mind-blowing, like, they wait the whole movie to deploy the IMAX until the last minutes, and it's the most effective use of IMAX ever. So I definitely praise that element of it, but I wasn't able to appreciate the, like, sad introspection of that movie until, like, I don't know. I feel like I need to mature. I feel like I matured between seeing it in theaters and seeing it at home in a big way that made that movie hit for me. But anyway, Babylon feels like a guy, in the same way, I don't know how you feel about David Robert Mitchell's Under the Silver Lake, but that's another movie that I felt like is all about him reacting to Hollywood, reacting to his movie. And this feels like a guy who loves movies and is trying to convince himself that he still loves making movies in spite of the business and how much he hates the business of making movies. And I just told, as I said, I was skeptical too the whole time. It's very messy. It's jumping around. It does lose that character for a long stretch. But then when the movie ends and how it brings him back, the jazz, what's his character's name? It's like the black jazz singer.
It's Sydney.
The trumpet player who like flourishes in sound for a minute, but and then like racism runs him out of it, basically. I love that arc just when it hit me that like the only person in this movie that gets a happy ending, so to speak, in the traditional sense, is that character who fucking leaves Hollywood. That's like his arc, I think. And I thought that was really powerful when that hit for me at the end. And like, that's just the whole thing. Basically, all these little moments came together for me at the end. And like, there's this clever thing that either I think it's a very polarizing moment and it colors the whole rest of the movie for you, whether you think it's brilliant or you think it's a cheap move. And I found it to be brilliant. And I thought it tied everything together. Like, it makes like the connections to movies I've been mentioning. I don't want to ruin anything. It makes connections to the movies it's referencing literal and real, and like kind of bakes them into the world of the movie in a way that I found very clever, and then goes on to make like a fourth wall breaking meta like celebration of the movie's moment that I have to admit, like, I think I laughed at it when it came up in the theater. Like, it's but like out of like that kind of laugh you do when you don't know what else to do, because you're kind of like shocked. Like, my jaw was like on the floor almost. I was like, wow, did they really just do this? Like, wow. And then like, I think I went through in like a moment, in like in the matter of 30 seconds, probably went from probably wanting to, my instinct was to laugh at it, at that idea. And then just the earnestness of it, it just got me. And I'm like, fuck no, he got me. I love this movie. It just is that the moment that crystallized that you didn't really like it, or did you think that elevated it? Like, I'm curious. I've been talking a lot.
It's okay. The whole, man, it's hard. Okay, the
montage. I don't want to spoil it.
The big money shot montage of like,
sure,
the movies are amazing. really, after I spent 3 hours telling you like the business that maybe they're not so hot. Terrible.
Yeah, right. yeah.
It's like, yeah, I get it. And I found it to be far too manipulative. I mean, the way that it's not a full like montage of what I think it's trying to do, which is like history of the movies, because that would take forever. It would be a much longer movie on its own if they try to do that. And I know it's
I think it's the constantly shifting nature of the industry is what it's showing, and how
exactly, yeah,
over yep. time, you know, maybe not forgotten, but like it just moves and you're going to be forgotten. Yeah.
But, and I know we joked, I joked about it with you, but I really hate that specific type of ending this movie has, which is the unearned smile. I hate that. I cannot stand that, because after you watch all this and then it's like, oh, but you know what? The character is okay for some reason after all of this misery that he's been through.
I feel like this ending gave me what I wanted, like from what Empire of Light was trying to give me at the end. And it's like, this definitely,
this is definitely better than Empire of Light, both as a love letter to movies, even if it's not really a love letter to movies, and just sort of telling you what the movies mean in some way. It's saying it does have something to say about the movies, and specifically the making of the movies and the ephemeral nature of
the immortality, you know,
pop culture and all that. I get it. I just didn't find it that interesting because I've seen all this before. I didn't find the characters to be that rich, even though the performances are really good. I really do feel as if the jazz trumpeter character is Chazelle trying to atone for La La Land and Ryan
Gosling's
character,
like Black Jack,
in a very overt way.
Sure. I didn't consider that, and that's funny and true, probably.
Yeah. I didn't buy the moment, the single moment of overt racism in the movie that puts it on that character instead of suggesting or even showing that racism was pretty prominent, not only in the making of the movies, but the movies themselves.
Sure.
It's a little bit disingenuous, a little bit too distant from what it's trying to make. And I don't know why, if you're going to introduce that character and introduce that idea of blackface and not confront it head on in a way that says something about it and criticizes it and says, and if you're going to make the connections between then and now, as the final part of the movie does, you know, I don't know, maybe the fact that this character is just shoved off to the sidelines for so long is Chazelle trying to say like, hey, look, it's still around, because in my movie the one major black character isn't as important. I don't know if that's like 4D chess move. I don't know.
You want to give him credit. Like, it's one of those things where if you like the movie, you're going to give him credit for that. And if you don't, you're going to not. You're going to be like, nope, it's a knock. I'd be interested to hear what the actor thinks. And, you know,
I would too. Yeah.
I'd be fascinated to know that, because I think it's a delicate balancing act, that particular thing. And I think the way it just hit me. Like, it's one of those things where, like, sometimes you have to read about a movie to understand, like, what the arc was or, like, what you think something was. That's one of those moments where it just hit me, like, 100%. Like, oh, that's why he disappeared from this movie. Like, they were saying, if you want a happy ending, fucking leave Hollywood. which is, like...
But it's not just that he disappears from the movie. He's not in the movie, like, for a good chunk of it. There's like parts where it's like he shows up and he's like on stage performing, and then suddenly he's an important character, even though we've been following him for a while. There's a lot more to it. And again, it's not just that character. It's all the characters. They're all superficially intriguing. And then,
I've seen a lot of criticism of Margot Robbie's character as like this unlikable narcissist. And I'm like, sure. She's playing an actor. Like, that's kind of the whole rub of the thing. So like, it's like baked into me that like her character is not necessarily likable and is doing like, you know, bad things or whatever. I think, the performances are all great. And I agree. I wanted to not like the characters either. Like, again, it took me until the third act of everything tying together before I was like, no, I really get what he was doing with these characters, even if they don't, maybe if their arcs don't come together in like a, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson-y way that you wanted to or something. But I thought it was elegant enough the way they were all handled. I was surprised by how much I liked it, and it's only gotten higher in my estimation since I saw it. I'm just so on board with the ideas it's exploring that I don't mind that it's occasionally kind of messy and confounding, and that so many other movies have like done what it's doing. That's like the biggest issue, I think, for a lot of people, is it's just like, yeah, it's a love letter to the movies. Like, there's like been eight of those this year alone. And like, there's been so many movies about this specific moment in the industry and stuff like that. It's just, it all feels like well-trodden material. So that's why I was hesitant too, but I do think it ends up being its own beast. And I love that it's like this Damien Chazelle. It feels very personal. It feels very, I just like that it wasn't what I expected. I didn't expect it to be this thing, this movie that argued that the transition to sound was maybe bad and like a mistake. And like, it's an interesting conceit. And I love the ideas, like several of the ideas in the movie, like the ideas that movies are not just an escape for the viewers, the audience, but for the people making them as well. That was really sweet. I thought the way that manifested, the celebration of the lowbrow throughout, I feel like eventually came through to me what they were going for. But even if it didn't make me laugh initially or whatever. The only way to avoid the inevitable vicious cycle of getting chewed up and spit out by Hollywood is to leave, as I mentioned earlier. And like, not only will Hollywood move on from you before you're ready to move on from it, but the industry will take your story and repurpose it for others to consume as entertainment. There's like a dual-sidedness of that. Like, there's that Jean Smart monologue that's basically her spouting the thesis and exposition of the movie. But I think it's a great scene God, Brad Pitt's so good in this, and so is Jean Smart. But it's just the dual-sidedness of the Hollywood repurposing things. Like, I feel like the final scene in the theater is a happy moment, right, for Manny, because, I mean, we got the smile. But there's also a sadness to it, I think, when you factor in the Brad Pitt being left behind stuff and how he reacts and how he... like, it's a celebration of the immortality at the same time. There's definitely an insidiousness to it because the rest of the movie's so insidious. I feel like it's just an interesting, weighty thing. It's like definitely more than meets the eye, I think, rather than less than meets the eye, which is like my inkling was at first to think it was less than meets the eye. And I do think there's more to it. I think it pairs very nicely. Obviously, there's a lot of movies about the magic of movies, but specifically this year, I think it pairs great with Nope, because Nope is a movie about the industry chewing up artists and spitting them out and stuff like that. Like, all the metaphors literally for that movie. Yes, literally.
So that, like, literally.
Literally that. So, like, it's a literalization of the same ideas on display here. And Blonde is also kind of about, in a way, about the industry doing this to, you know, people and stuff. There, though, that would be, like, a crazy triple feature if you wanted to, like, spend 9 hours or whatever watching really sad shit. But Babylon isn't, like, it is sad. It has it's an epic. It has comedy. It has tragedy. I appreciate the meta nature of it too. Like, it being this epic and what it is and what it's saying about itself while it's commenting on other movies. I think it's really bold and ambitious and audacious. And I don't think it's going to work for most people. It's one of those things where I wouldn't recommend this to the layman. I would have to be like, do you like movies a lot? Like, are you a historian? Do you watch TCM? Do you listen to You Must Remember This with Karina Longworth? Have you read, you know, what's the name of the woman who Nelly is based on? Who wrote
Clara Bow.
Clara, have you read the Clara Bow book? Bow. Like, it's one of those, like, for the critics, not the fans. I'm just kidding.
I am curious how it's gonna play.
I think it's gonna bomb very badly. I think it's gonna lose a lot of money and have like a B- cinema score at best. Like, it's not gonna be good. But that makes it all the more interesting to me, of course. And I'm giving it a 3.5 out of 4 Roger Ebert trademarked stars. We're moving on from the thumbs. It's trademark stars.
Yeah, now. No more thumbs.
He doesn't own the stars. We can just say stars. Yeah. But thank you. We're specifically using the Roger Ebert stars. So they're 3.5 Roger Ebert stars for me out of 4, with the caveat that, like, in the future, I could see this being a 4-star movie if I were to watch it again. And I feel like my troubles might melt away. The things that I found messy, or maybe there's more to meets the eye. I know you're at 2.5.
I'm at 2.5. Yeah.
Is there more you want to say? I know I've been talking a lot.
Oh, no, don't worry about it. I mean, because obviously you clearly liked it and got a lot more out of it than I did.
And I talked about it more on the New Flesh podcast with Jesse Hassinger on a bonus episode on Patreon. If you want to hear me talk about it even more, please.
Even more. But even it's more. A 2.5 for me because I was divided on it the first time I saw it. I watched it again because I wasn't 100% sure how I felt about a lot of it. And a second viewing really kind of just confirmed, like, yeah, I'm just kind of on the fence about this movie with some really great scenes, some really great performances, and then a lot of stuff that feels like filler and material that could have been fleshed out a lot more. That's where I'm at. And I really, I didn't like the ending.
I feel like it's crucial.
I found it so
crucial moment.
That's where I'm at. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I disagree. It was the moment that crystallized everything for me. So there you have it. Divisive movie is divisive. That's the headline here. we can move on to the next film. I think in the order I have it, is it Puss in Boots? Yes. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, might be the best movie out this week. I'm just kidding. I love Babylon too much to say that, but it would have hit any other week. It's a very strong film, unexpectedly strong movie. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. The last Puss in Boots movie was 11 years ago. And the last Shrek movie,
it was 2011.
Yeah. And the last Shrek movie was even like a year before that. So it's just wild to me that there's a new Puss in Boots movie that's ostensibly a sequel to the other one. It has the same characters. It came out 11 years later after the franchise was already dead. But here it is, and it's good. And it's an argument for every animation studio to blatantly rip off Spider-Verse, which was like the hand-drawn animation that everyone loved mixed with the 3D stuff. And it looks great, and they did it. And if there was one thing I hated about the Shrek things more than anything else, it's they haven't aged well visually. They look like crap. And this movie looks great. And here it is. Take a look for yourself. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. Get on YouTube if you're on the podcast and watch the trailer.
We are gathered here today to say goodbye to Puss in Boots.
Puss in Boots, you are down to your last life. You need to retire.
Oh, brother cats, sister kitties, meet your new roommate.
Well, I'm supposed to be a fearless hero, a legend.
Shrek! This is a person party. That's your party.
So this is where dignity goes to die.
So that trailer, I'm sure it would get there, but we didn't really get to the plot of it beyond the opening, like, classic hero from the movie is retired and grows a beard and is in retirement and then has to be called back into action. So the movie is him getting called back into action more so than that trailer. But, what is this movie, Mark? And why it's so funny that every critic before you gave it 3.5 stars, which is just on its face sounds silly. And it was just every other critic. Every other critic did the same thing. So I was like, there's no way Mark's going to be on that boat too. Like, there's no way the movie's that good. And then you did. And then I saw it and I also did. So just to say, it's a kid's movie, yes, but I am an adult. I don't have children, and I quite enjoyed it, and Mark is the same. So what is this fucking thing?
So Puss in Boots is, long delayed. I don't even know if anybody wanted the sequel to Puss in Boots, let alone to let the Shrek franchise continue. And now at this point, I'm kind of like, let's keep going. I mean,
they had mentioned
not?
A Shrek reboot and some point in time recently, so I think that's happening. And at first I was like, sounds like the dumbest thing on earth. And now I'm like, if they reboot it in this style with, like, I mean, this one had the same characters, so maybe I don't know how they're going to, if they're going to bring Mike Myers back or what, if they're truly going to rebooting an animation thing is so weird. We're going to draw it differently, but maybe they will. But, and like, this movie proves like that would be great, because this is like reinvigorated with not only style, but like the comic, like it basically, this movie pulls off everything that the Shrek franchise was supposed to do, which is like send up fairy tales and nursery rhymes, but also like be a good example of one and be funny. And I think it's all those things. Sorry.
Yeah. So it's, I think just letting this whole thing just rest for a while, because more than a decade, and I wasn't a big fan of Puss in Boots. And as much as I like Shrek and Shrek 2, those sequels aren't, they're not much to write home about, but man, this comes out of nowhere, and it starts off with Puss in Boots doing this giant action sequence, fighting a giant, and the way that it's stylized, you kind of hinted at it, it is that Spider-Verse sort of animation where you can't tell, like, wait, is this 3D animation? Is this hand-drawn? Like, is there, like, jitters in the frame where it just seems like they're cutting? Is it supposed to, like, represent sort of, like, the turning pages of a storybook right. or something? Is some of this stuff claymation? It's hard to tell. It's so uniquely designed and animated that I was just, I started to forget like they were doing that until an action sequence popped up again. Anyway, Puss in Boots dies, and it turns out he's on his last life. And one of the things I really liked about this film, and it's going to sound really dark, and it is kind of dark, but it's about mortality. It's about facing the idea of death and how you're going to live and whether you're yes. going to just sit back and wait for it and do nothing or risk it all and try to do something with your life. And I was not expecting that. You have the big bad wolf comes in as the literal manifestation of death in this movie.
And he's genuinely scary. Like, I'm not joking.
Yeah.
It was like, I was in like a Dolby theater, like a huge sound system, the biggest way I could see it. And I was genuinely like, it was like the middle of the afternoon. No one was there, but if there were kids in the audience, I would have expected a lot of them to be genuinely afraid of what happened. Like, not only is he scary, but like the movie like is well made and like is so like when he appears, it's like loud and scary and cut scarily. Like, it's scary.
Yeah, so there's all that element, and that works really well. The villain is really good. John Mulaney voices Big yes. Jack Horner. This yes. little Jack Horner grown up and kind of like resentful of the fact he's just a nursery rhyme. So he runs this pie factory and is trying to gather all the magic in the world. That's a great character. A great bit has like a Jiminy Cricket type character trying to be his conscience. I won't go any further than that, but that's a really funny bit.
Very funny bit.
Selma Hayek comes
Jimmy
back
Stewart
as
Cricket.
Yeah. So Selma Hayek comes back as Kitty Softpaws, who has this nice sort of regretful relationship with Puss. Antonio Banderas is still great. The real standout is Harvey Guillen as Perro, who's like a dog pretending to be a cat who tries to be Puss's therapy dog. Just a really funny character because he's so optimistic and his life has been a nightmare.
Just horrible.
And it's so, yeah. Oh my, it's so funny. This movie goes really dark, but it does so in a way that's so smart and funny.
And that's
and
what I think
has some things.
When I think of Shrek, that's what I think of when I think of Shrek is like that idea. And I feel like this does everything that those movies did better. You know what I mean?
There's a lot. Yeah, it does a lot that Shrek did, and it does it differently. And you were right. It is a sort of a parody, sort of a send up of fairy tales and everything. But it is actually a really good fairy tale story. So all these characters are trying to find this wishing star that crashed like years, decades, centuries ago. Who knows? And they all have these different wishes. So Puss wants his life back, his lives back. Kitty Softpaws wants to be able to trust somebody. Goldilocks is a character here. She's voiced
Florence
by Florence
Pugh.
And she is now like adopted by all the bears and she wants a real family. And that entire subplot is really affecting. I thought it was just a gimmick. And it turns out to be like these really well-developed characters and relationships. I was not expecting that.
Because the gag is just funny. Because it starts with them as like, it's like the crime family. And you're like, oh, this is funny. They're a crime family now together. And then it does morph into like a treatise on found family, which we'll get later in a movie called Broker, and we'll get the meditation on life and death in another movie called Living. So there's a lot of double features today that will
work. There's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot. If you feel like doubling up on movies this Christmas weekend. I was genuinely shocked by this and shocked by how much I liked it and how much I admired it, how much I appreciated everything that it's trying to do, not just stylistically, but also thematically and narratively. It is just a really, really solid movie.
Go ahead.
That's really it. I mean, it's just really well written, really well performed, and really well animated.
I was going to say one thing that annoyed, I think, people about Shrek, definitely annoyed me about Shrek as an adult. I think it didn't bother me as a kid, but it was pop culture references as jokes or like when those just sub in for jokes and like those are never funny. And this doesn't do that at all. The humor all comes from like character stuff and it's all really great. And the way, like, the dog's arc pays off with him trying to look cute. Like, that is so good. Like, it's all stuff that you can see coming, like, screenwriting 101 shit. But it's very effective. It is, it's delightful. Like, that's the only word that comes to mind. And I think Harvey Guillen is about to get the Josh Gad as Olaf career bump from this role. He's very good. And Puss in Boots is honestly, I didn't know I liked the character so much, but it is... It's definitely all the performance, right? It's all Antonio Banderas. It's just that, I mean, I love cats. It's an orange cat. I'm going to like it anyway. But it, Antonio Banderas, I think it was, I forget who it was, Sean Connor, a comedian I follow, who just was like, the way Antonio Banderas says, Puss in Boots belongs in a museum. And he's right. The specific way he says it and how often he fucking says it in the movie. Like, he says it like 15 times in the first like half hour. And every time it makes me laugh. It's just a great performance. He seems like a fun guy. Am I really going to do this? Yes. 3.5 stars. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish.
3.5 stars for me too. It's a best of the year contention, surprisingly, for me.
It's a great movie.
It's so good.
It's so good. I hesitate to say it's my favorite animated movie of the year because I feel like Turning Red was a really, like, I feel like that's a perennial. It's going to be like a movie people show their kids to teach them about growing up and stuff like that. But like, this is a great movie that should be a classic as much as Shrek is a classic, if anything. Like, it's very good. I hope it makes money. It feels weird to like root for a DreamWorks huge movie like for children that always inherently they always do well anyway, but like it still feels risky now to release anything. So I hope this movie makes money, and I hope it leads to every other studio stealing this animation style and doing unique stuff. And if this is how you want to reboot well, I can't even say it. I guess I did though. If this is how you want to do something, reboot something, I'm all for it. I think it's a great it was a great movie. Let's see what's next. Another movie that, well, this is a movie I'm going to be in the minority on, generally speaking. This is a movie I liked. Most people rightfully don't like it for all the right reasons, but I like it because I'm trying to embody the Roger Ebert ethos, right? The like, judge each movie on its own merit and for what it is. And I feel like the difference between why I like this movie fine and other critics are just like, it's just as bad as Bohemian Rhapsody. What are you talking about? Is because I like knew going in what I was going to get. Like, I accepted the framework of this movie is going to be a canned biopic that's like Lifetime style, Wikipedia skimming, greatest hits. And as that, with those parameters, I think it's a good one of those, but that is a limiting review. We'll get into it. This is called I Want to Dance with Somebody, which was confusingly called in all the official markings, Whitney Houston, : I Want to Dance with Somebody, which is not the official title on screen. I know a lot of critics were upset about that. Were you waiting for that drop as well?
I will say I was somewhat, I mean, I wasn't forced to change the title in my review, and I didn't, but you know, it's a marketing title, and I did acknowledge the fact that, yeah, it in the marketing it's called Whitney Houston, : I Want to Dance with Somebody. And then, yeah, anyway, it's a long boring story about how people come up to you in emails and be like, hey, can you change this the 2 days before Christmas? Like,
so funny. All right,
it is I Want to Dance with Somebody. That's my story. I'm sticking to it.
Yes, that's the title of this movie. Here it is.
Common criticism of you, your music isn't black enough.
Well, who said that? That's just bull. And it makes me angry, actually. It's hateful and uninformed. My whole life, she ain't black enough. She ain't white enough. Well, how about she's not obedient enough? How about she ain't fearful enough? Music is not a color to me. It has no boundaries. I sing what I want to sing, be how I want to be, and reach as big an audience as I can. We'll
love you. No one is like you. You can sing.
Whitney, your daddy's princess. We're building something here, so you just keep singing.
Yep, that's the movie, all right. Mark, tell me what this movie is and why most critics are right to say what you're saying about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very curious your argument, but yeah, let's.
It's not a strong one. It's not a strong argument.
No, that's fine. But I have one. You don't need to have a strong argument. Just an argument. That's the important part. So Whitney Houston's life from like being a teenager and singing in the choir until her death. Well, right before her death, is dramatized in Casey Lemons, who's a great filmmaker, by the way, who really needs to start doing some other stuff right now. I Want to Dance with Somebody. And that's it. It features a lot of songs. It features a lot of lip syncing. Naomi Aki plays Whitney. And I think it's a fairly thankless role, although there's a lot of stuff right at the top that I found really interesting. I thought it was going to go a little bit as a deeper dive than just the encyclopedia article about Whitney Houston's life. Because it brings up some ideas about her having a romantic relationship with another woman and all of that being tossed to the side because of the way that her parents and not her record executive, which is a weird character. Let's get into that. I like the character, but we can get into that later.
Subversion of evil record producer instead becoming record producer with the heart of gold, who is the only one in her life who cared about her.
Exactly. Yeah. It's produced by that record producer, by the way. Oh, the movie itself.
You don't say.
What a shock.
Yeah.
I'm sure he is a very nice guy. It's a little suspicious, though.
Yeah.
Where did this idea that her entire life has to change so that it's she can become famous?
Right.
That's all.
I'm a really good guy t-shirt has a lot of people asking questions already answered by my I'm a really good guy t-shirt. That's how it feels.
So it's the encyclopedia life, and I was really hoping for something more in depth from the opening, and then it just really becomes song after song, performance after performance, scene in the recording booth after scene in the recording booth, scene of Whitney being betrayed by Bobby Brown or her father or kind of her mother or even kind of the friend, and also being, you know, tastefully portrayed to be a drug addict in a way that I both appreciated and by the end really didn't care for, because it feels dishonest about the nature of addiction in a way that I don't think the movie intended to be. I think it is trying to be more respectful of Houston and her legacy and making it more than about how she died. And I appreciate that, because if it had gone the other way, if it had just been this exploitative movie about everything that she went through in her life, that would have been really awful. And it would have felt really terrible to dramatize all that. So I get the instinct to just be like,
yeah, it's,
we're going to take it careful. Yeah. But by the end, it doesn't feel quite right to me that, like, you can just say, oh yeah, addiction was a part of her life and, you know, it's how she died ultimately, but you never get a sense of that. It just feels like an impediment, it's passed off to the side.
They don't want to talk about it, for sure.
They don't portray the reality of it, the drama of it.
They just don't, the harsh reality of it. It's not there. It's definitely like a movie approved by the estate as much as it zigs. Like, I think the other thing that zigs outside the lines is the portrayal of the lesbian relationship that I didn't know about, that I don't know how much truth there is to it, but I would assume there's truth to it. And like, that is an impactful, that helped some of the story go down for me. Like, the movie is so greatest hits Wikipedia skimming, like, just like literally the movie just cuts to like, well, let's find another song for you to write, and then she's writing another classic song that, you know, and like, yes, it follows this template exactly, but I think it colors within those lines good enough, and the central performance is strong enough, and the songs inherently powerful enough and well staged enough in the movie that I thought the movie went down easy. Like, I did not want to go to this. I did not want to go to this movie. I reluctantly went. I sat in the actually sold out, quote unquote, full screening of people, and it went over well. People reacted to it. I watched it. It washed over me. I had my emotional reaction to it, and I walked away from it. I'll never watch it again. But like, it did what it was supposed to do. And I know this is like, it seems like it definitely is like a damning with faint praise thing, but like, I knew I was getting a VH1 Movies That Rock style movie. Like, these movies aren't high art. They're not going to do anything. Like, I've said a million times that like Walk Hard has ruined this type of movie because they all have to follow that same structure, and they do. And this one absolutely does. It doesn't do anything that any of these other ones do differently. It does those things. But I think it's more that my expectations are what's changed. And I knew that going in. And it definitely isn't any... I hesitate to say it's not a better movie than Bohemian Rhapsody. It is a better movie than Bohemian Rhapsody, if only because central performance in that movie sucks. And it was like, you know, edited to shit because like a director left the movie and it just didn't come together. This also, you could argue, is jumbled, but it does feel like a director's vision still to me. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. It does. It does. It's definitely better. And I hate that we have to compare it to Bohemian Rhapsody just because of the screenwriter. But it is a better movie than Bohemian Rhapsody for sure.
And like, it's not just because the screenwriter wrote both and it does reek like he did. Like, it just, it feels like he, like, you know, scratched out Freddie Mercury and wrote in Whitney. Like, it does feel like that at times, except for the subversion of the record producer thing, which it's funny in like a, and I just love Stanley Tucci, so it's nice to see him in the role. He was good. It's a nice relationship. It's nice. It's fun to watch. It doesn't make it go down easier that he produced the movie. It makes it funnier that he produced the movie, but it calls into question the entire, the honesty of the entire endeavor for sure. But I did appreciate it as like a filmic subversion of a trope. Like, you have to expect this from this movie, and they don't give you that. Like, it's the one thing they subvert. But I don't think it was like intent, the director saying, I would like to do a subversion, please. I think it was the producer of the movie saying, no, I'm the hero here. We're nice. I'm a nice guy. So yes, this movie is Bohemian Rhapsody with the Whitney Houston skin added to it, but I can't really explain why it's better than that, but I do think it is. It's like, again, I'm going to, as I should every week, I'm going to allude to Roger Ebert here and cite him for, like, I can't be mad at this movie for achieving exactly what it set out to do, right? Like, this movie's aims are unambitious. It's supposed to be a biopic about Whitney Houston that isn't troubling. Like, it isn't going to upset anybody. It's going to honor her for her fans that like her and want to hear her music and enjoy that. And then that's really all it is. Like, it doesn't dig any deeper. If you're not a fan, I didn't know much about her. I found it like surface level interesting. And like, I know that Bobby Brown was much bigger of a piece of shit than he's portrayed as here, even though he is the butt of a joke a lot of the movie, and like the movie treats him badly, but there's still something to it that's like sanitized. It just feels sanitized. Yeah. The whole thing is like sanitized version sanctioned by the family or the state or whatever. It definitely is all that.
A team of lawyers. I assume.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, but Bobby Brown, that entire relationship is so watered down, and it does not, oh man, it's uncomfortable at times.
It's hard for me to defend it. I don't want to oversell it. I'm definitely understanding of all the critiques everyone has, and they're all fair. And if I have one, it's that I was fully impressed with the musical numbers and the lip syncing that appears to be happening the whole time.
Yeah,
the last scene where it's such a three-part harmony, ballad, medley, whatever it is. And it's such a, like, the whole scene, it's like, again, Bohemian Rhapsody is the same thing, right? Where they do like the whole performance at the end or whatever. It's like that same deal. And it's a big climactic moment and the camera lingers on her. Or I don't know what it is about that scene that makes it different, but I really noticed that it's like, that's Whitney Houston's music and voice coming out of a woman that is absolutely not doing it.
Because if I remember correctly too, I think the end credits, like right at the very end, the little coda at the end has footage of Whitney Houston performing that, but without the song, without the music. When the only time you see Whitney Houston in this movie, she's silent, but mouthing the words to the songs you just heard. And yeah, you could tell like she's a one of a kind performer. And while Achy occasionally gets to that level in terms of the physicality, yeah, I mean, it's hard to replicate that. And
yeah, it's impossible. And that's why it's impressive that through most of the movie, I was like, wow, like that looks good. This sounds good and looks good. And I love the music. I'm bopping along to it.
Songs are great. Like, we all knew the songs are going to be great, but I mean,
I know. It's just, I'm giving it 3 stars for the, tell your mother to go see it for Christmas. She'll like it.
Yeah, I get it. I've definitely given positive reviews to movies that probably don't quite deserve them, but I feel conflicted about it. I get it. And this one is I'm giving it two. It's not awful. It's definitely not awful. If you like Whitney Houston's music, you're definitely going to get a nice little compilation of the greatest hits here. Right. Yes. And I think it's, I'm conflicted about how her addiction is portrayed, but I think doing it tastefully shows that, you know, Lemons actually does care about her as more than just a performer and a famous person. So I do appreciate that. And you're right. There is a vision. You know, Lemons is a filmmaker. She knows what she's doing.
And you know what?
I hope she gets some more work and does some bigger projects than this. And that's where I'm at with her. But you could tell, this is her vision. And she does have a clear-eyed view of how she wants to present Whitney Houston in this movie. And you could tell that.
And even if it's kind of a corny conceit, like, I thought the structure worked as like an arc for Whitney. The idea that, like, she was, you know, I don't sing a song unless I am ready to, like, until I believe it. Like, I can't sing a song I don't believe in. And, like, the movie weaves that into, like, her living her life and getting life experience. And then, like, oh, I can do that song now because I know what that feels like. And I think that arc, like, I think a lot of people are like, it's a mashup of greatest hits. There's no narrative here. And I would agree, like, yeah, there's not much of a narrative, but I think there is more of an abstract, like, this movie is a little bit better than you're giving it credit for thing going on with regard specifically to that, the way it depicts her life informing her song choices, even if it's just a device created for a biopic. I thought it was an effective device and a little elegant touch that made the, like, really arch, like, oh, here's a tape of someone singing the demo of the famous song of yours, and you have to be like, oh, this is it. Like,
it's, I know this song.
Yeah, it's tough to, like, sit through those, but, like, I think the movie did an okay job of telling the story and not making me roll my eyes more than it needed to. But I completely understand that it would make most people roll their eyes. So,
and I get why you liked it, but I also don't get
we're
why
so
you
respectful.
Liked it. I get how you liked it. No, I get it. I get how you liked it. I don't understand why you liked it, but that's right.
I love it. That's a perfect place to be conceptually. All right, let's get into a movie that was just shortlisted at the Oscars for Best Foreign Film. We don't know if it'll make it into the final five or whatever it is. But here is the trailer for Vicky. Is it Creeps? Is it Cripes?
Great question. Let's find out in the break.
we'll come back and give you that answer. Here's the trailer for Corsage.
Dann in dem richtigen Moment so. So und dann.
Eine Aufgabe ist es, die Geschicke dieses Reiches zu lenken. Deine Aufgabe ist es, lediglich zu repräsentieren. Dafür habe ich dich ausgewählt, dafür bist du da.
Nur jedem Impuls, jeder Laune nachgibst, ohne an deine Rolle zu denken.
A lion doesn't lose sleep over the opinion of sheep.
I love to look at you looking at me. Sie ist ein Buch für mich. Auf jeder Seite steht ein Rätsel.
We have What's Her Name in Corsage.
I am failing us here. I cannot listen to the pronunciations online, so I'm failing us.
I'm going to go with, I feel like I used to hear people when Phantom Thread came out, I think they said Creeps, but it sounds wrong. So we're going to say Vicky K. Vicky K, our girl from Phantom Thread. She stars in Corsage. Is this a French film?
Austrian
film. Shortlisted at the Oscars. What is this movie, Mark?
Sorry, I'm doing some homework while I'm doing this. So it is about Empress Elizabeth of Austria, who reigned with her husband over the Austro-Hungarian Empire, basically. And it's sort of it's a revisionist history of her life, especially by the end, but that's irrelevant. to the point. The point of this is more about the attitude of the character and what she represents in terms of royalty and the privilege of royalty and also the potential tragedy of royalty. And what I'll say is, as a movie, I found it more interesting depicting the privileges of it and the sort of level of just vanity and not being aware of how your behavior and actions impact other people. There's a lot of stuff in here where she seems very philanthropic, like she visits this asylum for the mentally ill. But like the big thing that she has, her big moment is talking to this one man who's now silent. She's like, the last time I was here, you told me how beautiful I am. And she's like kind of expecting him to say the same thing, even though he's no longer speaking. And I found that to be really fascinating, if, you know, a bit familiar, but it's still interesting to see that. You see all of this wealth and privilege and everything. She can travel all over the world. She has these various manors and estates of her own and her families, and she could do all of this, and she's still miserable and unhappy and still wants something else because she just turned 40 and she feels old and forgotten and unloved and undesired. And it's interesting. I found the character, it's an interesting character study that I don't think quite pulls off what it's trying to do, because by the end it does try to make it very tragic, and I don't think it plays off that way.
Yeah, I don't think it pulls off the ending, even though I wish it did. Like, I wish it hit emotionally the way that it wants me to, that it wanted me to feel. But it didn't quite get there for me. It really felt like, this is a reference for my Rugrats watchers out there, it felt like Catherine Called Birdie All Grown Up edition, which it reminded me most of that movie. I think a lot of people would compare this to what's the main comparison you'd think of for this movie? Marie Antoinette.
Oh, obviously Marie Antoinette. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I guess Catherine Called Birdie reminded me of that a little bit, but like this feels like if that character grew to be 40, this is what she would be like. She would be fainting to get out of doing royal events and hanging out with her husband or whatever. So like, definitely, again, well-trodden material that I just don't think this movie does anything unique or different enough to differentiate it from the pack, even though it has such inspired moments, right? Like the one you described, and like how, like that, what that scene implies about her character, like when she meets that guy who's not speaking anymore. And like, there's that moment where the guy asks to film her and she's like, does this thing record audio? And he's like, no. So I can do anything as long as I smile. They can't hear me. Like, there are so many moments that like I wrote down like, ooh, great line. Like, this is so good. And it just never like, it never came together in a way that made me as excited as those moments did. Right. I guess that's the problem with it.
Yeah. But
like, why is that?
I don't know. I think it's because as a character, the character is inconsistent. I think Creeps is really good here. She's good at playing roles like this, but I don't think the character, it's hard to tell what the point and the purpose of the character is, whether we're supposed to feel as if this is privilege run amok, or if this is a woman who's way so far ahead of her time in terms of thinking about things that we're supposed to admire her, or if we're supposed to pity her because she's so wealthy, but she doesn't know who she is and she doesn't feel good about herself because she's in this bubble of royalty and all that. I don't know what it ultimately wants us to feel about the character. And I ultimately didn't feel much about the character.
Yeah. And like, you know, they have one visual metaphor and they hit it like 100 times. It's like the corset is restricting her. Do you understand? I feel like they fucked up and they meant to call it corset, but there was like a translation mistake.
I think corsage is like an outdated term for corset. So like in the period, it would have been appropriate.
Okay. Interesting. I was trying to think of like what the implication of it being called that are. Is what it, corsage, is that not like,
oh no, like, you know what, no, I take that back. Corsage is like the physical form that a corset makes. That's
interesting. Yeah, I was gonna say, for me, the reference point I had is like when you go to prom, you buy a corsage for someone, like the little flower that they put on their chest or whatever. So like, I was wondering if that was some like deep meaning of like putting your feelings, you're putting out one thing and feeling another. I don't know. It's probably
it's not the restriction. It's the appearance that you give being restricted, I think, is what the implication is.
There you go. There's just not much to it. It's okay.
Yeah, there's not.
It's like a 2.5-star experience. It's like good performance, almost there with the themes, but it's like a little too muted, right?
Yeah, that's, and I'm exactly on that too. It's a 2.5 experience for me too. It's just
right on.
Yeah.
All right.
I think that's where we're at with that one.
Let's jump to another movie that we might have a similar conversation about based on the rating, I think. This is a movie that has one title that I will officially tell you in a second, but I'm going to call it Decision to Leave. No, it's actually called, Women Talking. There was already a movie called Decision to Leave. And Women Talking could have also been called She Said. She Said could have been called Woman Talking. We could do this all day, but we won't. Here's the trailer for, I forgot what it is now. Women Talking.
Women Talking.
Thank you. This was a here is two men talking about women talking.
Where I come from, where your mother comes from, we didn't talk about our bodies. We were given 2 days to forgive the attackers before they returned. We hardly knew how to read or to write, but that day, we learned how to vote.
Do nothing.
Stay and fight.
Wait. Leave.
If we do not forgive these men, we forfeit our place even. Surely there must be something worth living for in this life, not only the next.
Oh, sorry. It's so fucking ugly that I vomited all over my laptop. Sorry. I cannot stand the, whatever you want to call the visual look of the sheen, the color grading. Is that what you say? The deliberate choice to make it look gray and hideous and drab, to presumably make us focus on the dialogue only, or if it was meant to like heighten the dialogue and the play-like atmosphere, all it did was distract more from it and make me more annoyed that, like, you could have made this look nice at least if I'm gonna have to like just listen to people talk and it looks terrible. Anyway, I liked it more than that tangent makes it sound like. It's not a terrible movie, but it is an underwhelming movie that I wish hit harder. It's one of those well-intentioned movies that I wish got its message across in a way that didn't feel like they were reading talking points at me, which it does feel like at times. Mark, what is this movie?
So this movie is somewhat inspired by a true story, and it's mostly based on a novel by Miriam Tays, who also co-wrote the screenplay with director Sarah Polley. It's about a Mennonite community. Women have been sexually assaulted, raped for years, apparently. And the men in the community were saying that it was basically either their imagination or it was somehow the work of the devil. Well, it turns out it was actually, obviously, a bunch of men within the community doing these crimes against women and girls. And so the women eventually realize what happened. The men lock them up. Someone tries to kill one of the men, obviously, and they ship the men off into the city away from the community to keep them safe. And now it's up to the women to vote on, and then three families of women within the community to decide on what they're going to do. They're either going to stick around and forgive these men, they're going to fight against the men and try to start like the community in their own liking, or they're just going to leave.
Or they're going to make a decision to leave.
Leave, exactly. I got it.
Thank you.
I don't know if it was worth forgetting the title of the movie, but it was a good joke.
Thank you. Got it. We'll hammer it in one more time before the end of the segment. Don't worry.
So it has a great cast. Rooney Mara and Claire Foy, Frances McDormand, very briefly, and
Jesse
Ben Whishaw.
Buckley.
Jesse Buckley. Oh, how can I forget Jesse Buckley? Jesse Buckley's great here. And Ben Whishaw as the Fraser Crane I'm listening guy for the whole thing. And in theory, I should really like this. It's a movie about people talking and having conversations and thoughtful conversations about
like
philosophy and
a lot of comparisons to 12 Angry Men, 12 Angry Women, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, something along those lines. I should really, really be involved in this. And I am not. And I don't know why. And I think I was trying to figure it out. And I think the main thing is the way that Polly just throws us right into this situation where we only have the knowledge of the crimes that have been committed and that this is what they're going to have to talk about. And suddenly we're just overwhelmed by discussions about religion on, and philosophy and all of these things that very much pertain to these specific people, and not, I think, in the way that the filmmakers might think, a more universal idea about these ideas. I think that might be what it is. I think it might be too specific without establishing what this world is actually like and what these characters actually want and where these concerns really matter, because they have these conversations like, if we leave, God's not going to be able to find us when he comes back to Earth to take us up to heaven. I'm like, that's kind of a weird
bad argument
to go on. Like, I don't, yeah. But if you had established that as a fundamental tenet of their faith, yeah, at some point, and somehow other than just bringing it up, maybe that would have hit harder and I would have been able to rationalize and figure out where these characters are standing. But when you just throw it in there, it doesn't quite hit in the same way. So I don't know. And you're right. I mean, you are right. It does look bad. I didn't mind it as much. But I think you could make, I think you have a good argument about, like, you know, if you want to focus on the dialogue, maybe the better way to focus on the dialogue is to actually light your characters appropriately, because stage plays, after all, are not done in the dark.
Right,
they're not done on a dim stage. You have to light your, you light your actors so you can hear them. And I think that goes for the movie too. I found I didn't quite make all the connections right away or on a second viewing even of who is related to who and how and why these specific characters are so important within the community. That seems to be just kind of left up to be discovered as the movie goes, but I don't think it gets there either. And so it's hard to tell where all of this is. And yeah, I just, it didn't quite hit. I did admire the fact that it is about ideas and it's about discussion, it's about conversation, and it's about debate. I like that. Just didn't hit me on an emotional level, on an intellectual level.
I think part of that is because they're having the same fucking conversation for the whole movie, and
yeah,
they're talking circles around each other. It's like, my biggest problem with the movie Pearl was the monologue everyone loves, where she restates the point of the movie 16 times. And like, this movie is that the whole time. It's just people spouting what feels like ready-made talking points that are like, you know, things people would say in like a thesis statement in like nowadays about patriarchy and stuff. And it just doesn't feel, it just never felt lived in or genuine to me. It always felt like I was watching a movie that was supposed to teach me something. It unfortunately did feel like you were like, a movie shouldn't feel like homework, and this one kind of did. I don't know why. I'm trying to get at it. Like, I think you're right. Like, we need richer characterization here. And like, bigger, doesn't it feel like it's like preaching to the choir in a way? Like, it's not trying to convince anybody of anything. It's just kind of, it just feels like it's saying things that the people who are watching it will already agree with, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Like, it just, like, I understand this is a relevant story, and like, it has like a M. Night Shyamalan, The Village-esque twist to it that I think is treated strangely in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if, I don't know if it, like, if it should have just been presented as such, because like, I felt like all I could think about was, wow, you truly just did the Village twist on us. And it was like a weird thing to do in this movie. It just like, it feels like there's good material here for a great movie, and this just isn't that movie. And like, I did think Sarah Polley, she's made movies. She made that, what, Stories We Tell, like that really personal documentary film that was good. But like, it seems like this is not a well-made movie. I feel like it's not well put together and it's not well edited. It feels like things are cut from it that should be in it. Like, Frances McDormand's role gets pretty cut short. It's just kind of a confusing movie. And then you read, like, the book had Ben Whishaw's character, like, him taking the minutes of the meeting was like the narrator of the book. And like, that adds like a layer of, you know, women talking, but it's a men recounting how they are speaking, telling the narrative. And that adds like a layer that I think is interesting and like completely missing from the movie. And like, that made me want to read the book and think that the book is actually like an impactful thing that would make me, that would like have the impact this movie wants to have, but doesn't, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I would be curious to read the book too, especially when you bring up that is the perspective it takes. Cause yeah, his character in this is just, you know, legitimately nice guy who actually does care about all of this happening. And he's there to, you know, listen, and he apologizes when he talks out of turn, even if he isn't talking out of turn and they want him to talk. I mean, yeah, it's he's the most well-developed character in this movie, which is maybe it's just because he's the only man in it. Maybe because of the costuming, he's dressed all in white.
And like,
if we're going to talk about the aesthetics and the staging of it, again, you can't make... If you're going to light your character or have him lit in a certain way, he's going to overshadow everybody else dressed in dark clothes sitting in a dark barn. It doesn't.
Yeah. And work. Like, if that was baked in like the way it is in the book, it may have worked better, but like, it doesn't work here at all. I don't think.
Yeah. The aesthetics do get maybe a bit more in the way than I thought they did at first, but
yeah. It just feels like, I don't know. Women Talking in Circles would be a better title for this movie. I really want to like it and agree with people who think it's like a really powerful movie. But I just, again, I'm a sap, and this movie is like ripe for making me like feel something and emotionally connected to it. And I didn't feel like I was watching a movie that was like generated to win awards for best ensemble. You know what I mean? I felt like I was watching people give monologues instead of watching characters live their lives. And that's a bit of a problem. It's still, I feel like I've softened, like I would have given it 2.5, but I want to give it 2. I feel like I should give it 2 out of 4.
That's where I was at with this. I'm still giving it 2.5. But I mean, we've talked about it. I kind of feel a little bit even less conflicted about it and feel a little bit more like, yeah, this isn't quite good, but I'm still going to give it 2.5 because I do admire what it's trying to do, even if I don't think it accomplishes it.
I mean, and to be clear, this is something that's like based on a true story of like, you know, between 2005 and 2009, 150 women were drugged and raped by men in like a Mennonite community. Literally in the middle of the night. Until,
you never
like,
get the scope of that.
I know.
You never get the scope the of movie, that either. Which
like,
is...
again, exactly. Everything I like about this movie is stuff I read about after the fact and go, wow, that's interesting and sad and messed up. Like, the movie doesn't give you what it needs to be as impactful as it could be. That's the bottom line for Women Talking. Beyond horrifying, women would wake up and see blood on their sheets and legs and thought that, like, you know, their underwear is missing, and they would think that like some religious horrible thing happened to them or the demon came to them. Nope, they were just being raped by men drugged and raped. Crazy. This movie does not play like the movie that's about that. It's too muted, which is something I think I said about another movie earlier, but I don't remember what already. It's all a blur. We're still going here. We've got a few more. The next movie we're talking about is the Bill Nighy starring Living. Bill Nighy is getting like best actor speculation at the Oscars for this. He's definitely getting some of the run-up awards for it. It's a remake of an Akira Kurosawa movie, which is like the most tallest order in history. And it's incredible that it pulls it off in such a nice, gentle way. Here is a trailer for Living.
Mr. Williams, a little on the frosty side, perhaps. Not much fun in laughter. Brother like church. What is it up? Small wonder I didn't notice when I was coming.
Dad, you're right.
If only to be alive for one day. But I realize it. I don't know how.
Do you think we should alert the police that?
This is a movie that kind of looks boring and looks like homework and like Oscar bait, but I can't recommend it enough, really. And I'll let Mark tell you why and what it is.
So, yeah, Living is, of all things, a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Akiru, which,
which translates as living.
To live, yeah.
Yeah,
right, to live. That's a really daring thing to do, to make a remake of a great film by one of the greatest filmmakers ever.
Remake one of the greatest filmmakers who ever lives, one of his greatest films. Yeah.
How do you do that? Why would you do it? This movie somehow pulls it off, and it's really good. I found it incredibly moving beyond Nighy's performance, which is great. You know, Bill Nighy is such a charismatic actor. He is so, to use a word you just used, he's so muted. He's so just ordinary and dull in this movie, and it works so well. That's the point. Yeah. You can tell that there is like this desire
he's to a bureaucrat.
Be something more.
Yeah.
And he's a government bureaucrat. He's a paper pusher. He sits behind the desk in front of a bunch of other desks cobbled together. That's been his whole life. He gets a diagnosis that he has terminal cancer and has 6 months to a year to live. And he realizes, I've never lived. And now that I'm about to die, I don't even know how to live.
So you could say that this was Akira Kurosawa's Funny People.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, why did you really hoping that, no. Hopefully that joke landed for at least one of our several hundred listeners. Please keep going.
I had to think about it. It's the first half of Funny People. It's the actual movie that Funny People should have been, the 90 minutes.
Guy who's
People.
Never seen Akira Kurosawa. This is a lot like 25th Hour by Spike Lee. Just has no reference point for classics. Sorry, yeah. No.
There you go. I got it. So yeah, the whole film is just Bill Nighy's character trying to figure out how to live and realizing, like, through all these different processes, Tom Burke shows up as this guy who's really good at going out and getting drunk. So he takes him out to go get drunk and realizes, oh, this is kind of empty and hollow and there's nothing to it. Amy Lou Wood is really good. This young woman who just seems to be full of joy and promise and everything that she could do. And he starts clinging to her like in this way. And it's not creepy. It's just very sincere. Like, I think you seem to be a good example of being a good person and living rightly, and I want to learn how to do that. It's just so good, and I cannot talk about why this movie like impacted me so much. It's got a screenplway by Kazu Ishiguro, who's a really well regarded novelist. He wrote Remains of the Day, and he wrote Never Let Me Go. Great novelist, all of that, and he does such a fantastic job of really focusing the story on those emotional beats and narrowing the scope of it. Yeah. You know, Kurosawa's film is long. This film is about like 45 minutes shorter.
I appreciate that about it so much. Not to disparage the iconic film, which is fantastic, but like getting a Nobel Prize winning author to do the adaptation is how you do a remake of a Kurosawa movie.
Exactly. And he knows exactly how to condense it to a point where it does get those beats. I don't want to say where it goes. The third act is completely different from everything that has come before it. It's not just about how you live, but also about whether or not the way that you lived meant anything. And
will it have a lasting impact? Yeah.
It really, really hit me hard. I found it so moving, and just beyond Nighy's performance again, just everything here just comes together so well. I'm shocked that they remade a great film into a nearly great film as well.
Yeah, it's an amazing feat for that alone. I totally agree with the power of it and how impactful it is and how good it is. And it's just one of those things where it's like, how did I get to December 2022 when most people I know saw this in January without anyone telling me like fervently, like you should see this. No one told me that. So I just want to strongly recommend it here and
it's
say
a good argument.
Seek it
it's
out.
Good argument.
Yeah, it's a really good.
Aren't necessarily the best place for film criticism.
Oh, absolutely, man! Like people totally. I mean, there are definitely people who saw it and wrote about it. Brian Tallarico at RogerEbert.com for one saw it in January, wrote a great review about it, and said it was great and that he would remember by the end of the year, and he was right. Three and a half out of four. Hesitate to say four just because it was almost insulting to Kurosawa or something. Like there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just like, it's based on something else. You know, I don't know. 3.5 feels right.
Yeah. I'm giving it 3.5 too. I've given it a very solid 3.5. We might be talking about it next week.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really just a shocking, like last minute, best of the year pick for sure. All right. We got a couple more. Let's talk about, Coretta. I don't ever know how to pronounce it. Coretta, Broker, the director of Coretta, the director of Japanese filmmaker. He directed most recently Shoplifters, which was like very acclaimed. He has a ton of other movies, and they're all about found family. And this one, you guessed it, it's about found family. It's called Broker, and it's a nice comedy drama about child
trafficking.
So, 우리 다 이 이제 행복해지자구나. 응?
내 엄마가 찾아갔다고?
유괴라뇨? 아니 무슨 말씀을 그렇게.
키워줄 부모를 찾는 거지.
선이라고 해야 되나?
선이 좋아하시네. 그냥 브로커잖아.
전문적인 브로커라고 보기에는 좀 뭔가 행동도 어설프고.
팔아서 돈 맞으면 전문 브로커지.
데리고 가야 돼?
출발 출발.
Oh, this is a nice movie. Mark, what is Broker?
So Broker is a film set in South Korea. It stars Song Kang-ho, who many will know from Parasite most recently. He's like a big star.
Yeah, I feel like Korea wanted to work with him so bad that he made a movie in South Korea instead of Japan.
Yeah. I think it's only the second time he's made a film outside of Japan. So it's kind of a big deal. Song plays this character who runs a laundry. He's in debt, and to pay off the debt and also for other reasons, he finds children that have been left in this baby box at a local church in Seoul, and sells them with the help of a character named Dong So, who works at the church.
Now, and explain the concept of a baby box for our non-South Korean listeners.
I mean, I think I don't know if
we have these.
We have like safe drop-off points at like any kind of fire station.
I never considered that. You're right. I guess in my mind, like I have like the antiquated vision of like someone dropping a baby off at the doorstep of a fire station or an orphanage. And like,
yeah, which is how this movie starts.
Right. You better hope someone comes because that baby's going to die of being frozen or whatever.
Yeah. So the baby box it's for, parents who decide they aren't going to keep their baby, but also, to keep the baby safe. There's a box. It's insulated. It sets off, a sound signal and, stays warm and safe from the elements. And it lets the people inside this institution, in this case, a church, know that there's a baby in there to recover and to determine what to do. So that's how the movie starts. Young woman leaves the baby behind. The two brokers, child traffickers, basically, take the baby and decide to sell it. And then
but
the mother
child traffickers
comes back
with hearts of gold who want the best for these babies in addition to the money.
Yeah, there's a lot here that I liked, and I think you bring that up, you just very simply putting it that way, that there is like the legal case of this is clear. What they're doing is illegal for obvious reasons.
Yeah,
whether or not what they're doing is moral, I mean, that's really determinant on what their motives are, and their motives are fairly pure. I mean, they just want these kids to have a happy home. Song's character has this backstory with his own family, so he has this reason to care about children and what kind of life they're going to have. And then his partner grew up in an orphanage, and he grew up in an orphanage because his mother left a note that said, that she'd come back, just as this baby had a note with him saying that the mother would come back. And you can't go up for adoption, apparently, by law in South Korea if such a note exists. So he wants to make sure this baby and other babies are taken care of by families who will love them. So it becomes weirdly a road trip movie about the two of them, the mother, the baby, and another kid from an orphanage who feels a bit tossed in just for like emphasized cuteness factor.
Sure.
Just going on a road trip trying to figure out who they could sell this baby to that will take care of the baby and get them the most money so that the guy can pay off some debt to keep the laundry open and so that everybody can be happy by the end.
Yeah.
I'm going to start sounding very negative about this movie, but I did like it mainly because
too.
Of the human elements.
I'm assuming you're going to talk about it being like melodramatic and what's your
yes point? To a degree. Yeah, so I like the human elements of it. I like the characters. I got a bit overwhelmed by all of the plotting that
yes,
it's trying
there's
to do.
Like, did I need the detective plot at all? I don't know.
Definitely didn't need the detective
Probably
plot.
Probably not. Yeah.
Definitely didn't need the murder plot. Definitely didn't need the gangster plot.
Yeah, you're right. It does. It's a little too much movie. It just goes a little off the rails and loses focus. Like, there's like a 90-minute movie version of this. It's like among the best movies of the year. right? But as is, it's like a little too much. I still liked it, but there's too much fat on it. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's so much fat on this, and it doesn't need to be there. And I don't know why. I mean, I know, and you know, from Shoplifters and whatnot, the creator can do these very, very character-specific, low-key dramas that are just about relationships and how people relate to each other and they bond and they connect, and things that, you know, that are impossible to avoid kind of tears them apart gradually. But this one is like, you know, it's gangsters and a murder and two cops who are trying to, you know, get these characters arrested. It's like, it's so much.
Yeah. That it's like, yeah.
Really distracts from it.
Yeah. Totally agree. The high stakes drama, it just doesn't feel right. It's like these nuanced character studies being told within this structure that doesn't fit. I totally agree. There was something I couldn't place what was wrong with the movie, and you just helped me figure it out. Because I did like it, but I didn't love it. Like, I like Shoplifters more, right? And it's and then you realize why. Yeah, it's a good, sweet movie that still ends up with a nice ending and stuff, but it's kind of a rocky path to get to the narrative. Like, it's not like a straight A to B. There's like a few weird destinations that I didn't need. I totally agree. But generally speaking, I recommend it if you're into this type of stuff. And it's another good example of one of these guys' movies, you know? It's like,
yeah, I mean,
I love an author who has like a movie he makes and he makes it over and over again. Nothing better than that. Does it well, yes. I'm giving a 3-star review. 3 out of 4.
Yeah, I'm giving, borderline 3-star for me too, just because I do have those issues that almost derail what it does so well, which is just explore these relationships and these characters. But man, it comes close to really falling apart too many
times. I agree, but it does ultimately pay it off. It could have fallen apart, and I'm glad it stuck the landing at least, because I did think it was off the rails for a bit at some point. All right, last movie of the week. I believe it's on Netflix next week, a week from today. You can watch White Noise on Netflix. I caught it at New York Film Festival. I feel like I talked about it on some other podcast. Maybe it was a bonus episode with Jesse. I'm not sure. But here is Noah Baumbach's latest film, White Noise, starring Adam Driver and Greta Gerwig. And it's based on an iconic novel by Don DeLillo, which I have, I think, right here somewhere. I haven't read it yet. I've been dying to. The movie, one of those movies you see, no matter what you think of the movie, I think it would inspire someone to be interested in the book, because it really feels like you're watching a book being adapted, for sure. Here is the trailer for White Noise, in theaters now and on Netflix next week.
That stuff causes cancer in laboratory animals, in case you didn't know.
Either I chew gum or I smoke.
What are these children, yours?
That's mine from Wives 1 and 3. There's Babette's from Husband 2. Wilder is ours. We're each other's force.
Life is good, Jack. I hope it lasts forever.
Let's watch a sitcom or something.
No!
They're calling it the airborne toxic event.
It won't come this way.
Will we have to leave our home?
Of course not.
How do you know?
I just know.
Okay, what if it's dangerous?
Evacuate all places of residence.
This is another movie that I really liked, I would even say loved, that I would have a hard time recommending to most people. It's such a specific thing tuned to my liking, like a satire about casual misinformation and the inherent contradiction of our fear of death, but also having the feeling that nothing bad will ever happen to us specifically. Like, that idea is so tailor-made for me. And as the target audience, happy to point out, the movie totally works for me, even if it does peter out a little in the third act. I think people calling this Spielbergian, which I've seen a lot, are really just mean it's like War of the Worlds, Spielberg War of the Worlds. I thought this pair, I've said this earlier today, was something else, but I think this pairs nicely with Nope as well. And this one's about like its examination of our relationship to spectacle. Jordan Peele kept citing car crashes in his press tour when talking about that movie and how we can't look away. And that's what Noah Baumbach starts the movie with here. And presumably the book, you know, is about that as well. I like this movie a lot. more than anything, it made me crave a proper Noah Baumbach horror movie, because there's like a horror sequence in here that I thought was kind of cool. Didn't know I needed that, but I really do now. And there's like a vintage Danny Elfman score that's instantly recognizable as Danny Elfman. And I like that about it too. I have no idea how you felt about this movie. Please tell
me. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I haven't.
One of those rare cases where there's no record of Mark seeing this film. I have no idea what happened.
I did see it.
I'm not too sure. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
And I also liked it. And
it's very divisive. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. The thing is, like, you bring up the whole Spielberg thing that people are saying, and like, there are some really impressive shots here. We just said, you know, Kureta is a filmmaker who makes the movie he makes. And Baumbach seems to be that kind of filmmaker too, where he makes these quirky, eccentric comedies. And then suddenly, like, you do this movie, which has some really impressive sequences in it.
Yeah, like it goes like blockbuster mode,
the giant toxic cloud.
Oh, it's
illuminated by the lightning around it in the clouds, and all the people staring up with the Spielberg eyes. And there is that horror sequence near the beginning. The ending is this really interesting thriller that it turns into, like in this runny, ratty hotel room. But all of that serves a purpose, which is to say, none of that really matters.
Yes.
Because the whole movie is just all about downplaying all of these big moments, because it is so weird. So Adam Driver plays the character who specializes in Hitler studies.
Yes.
Which is a field that he created.
Yes.
And for reasons that become kind of apparent, because he's terrified of death, but he doesn't really get into the whole reason how terrified he is. So when you have this toxic airborne event happening, he's just kind of delaying the inevitable and saying, like, oh, don't worry about it, it's not coming this way. It's a plume, it's nothing to worry about. It's really funny. And then there's all these absurd touches, all these characters that they keep meeting, and I really appreciate it. It's something I don't know, Baumbach clearly couldn't have known exactly, but I think it gets to the key of like how we are. But like, you have this giant event happen that seems to be catastrophic on every level. It's going to change life in every way. And then suddenly it doesn't matter. Everybody's just back to normal. They're going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out another.
I can't relate to that in any way. I don't understand.
I mean, it's so weird how that could happen. Yeah. It's such a prescient movie. And I think it just,
I know. And the book was written so long ago, and it's such a
classic. It was like in the 80s.
It's always mind blowing to find how prevalent, you know, how nothing's really changed, I guess.
Yeah, ever changes about us. And part of that is that we just keep distracting ourselves with a whole bunch of stuff. Like it seems like the characters seem to quote or have like product placement all around them at some point. And, you know, Don Cheadle's character is obsessed with trying to talk about Elvis. It's just really funny scene where the two of them like have this dueling lecture about the mommy issues that Elvis Presley had and Hitler had. I found that really funny. I don't know. It is, you have to get on its wavelength, and its wavelength is everything is absurd, nothing means anything, and you better find some reason to make something mean something in life. Otherwise, you're just going to be running around looking for a whole bunch of trouble or getting into a whole bunch of trouble. I was definitely on its wavelength pretty early, and I enjoyed it.
I agree with everything you say, and I also think you'll agree when I say that, you know, majority of the casual Netflix viewer will find this movie completely fucking confounding and like,
oh yeah,
like unengaging, unable to like, just like confusing. Like, what is this movie about? Like, you wouldn't be like, I feel like you and I could talk. You just told me what it's about, and I totally agree and get it. But I think a ton of people will watch this movie and not get a word of what you're saying out of it. You know what I mean? They would just be like, what the fuck was that? And that's cool. I appreciate that about it. As I said, it's one of those movies that really made me want to read the book, and I haven't, and I'm embarrassed because I know it's a classic. I have a lot of DeLillo books because a lot of movies of his I like Cronenberg did Cosmopolis. That's another one of his books.
Oh yeah, okay.
He seems like an interesting dude is all I mean to say. Good movie. Solid, very solid 3 out of 4 for me. Almost.
Yeah, I was pretty close. I watched it one more time just to kind of make sure, because there were some stuff in here that really like it hit me, and it stuck with me for a while.
Yeah, so I need to see it again. Like, I think it would go up.
Perhaps. Yeah, I enjoyed it, so I give it 3-2.
All right. Wow, cool. We did it. We talked about 8 movies in about 100 minutes. We done good. We'll be back next week with we haven't discussed, but I'm assuming it's a best of the year episode with a format that Mark is spearheading, and we will discuss off mic, and we will be back with next week. So thanks for listening. Thanks for listening for all of 2022, or half the year, I guess, since we started in June or July or something. But we're continuing onward through the new year. And that's the plan. So we'll see you. Bye.
The show starts in one.
Shut up. Ush.